We're going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order, and I just wanted to start off with a couple of housekeeping items. I first want to extend my thank you to the members that were able to make it to the committee hearings that we had in February. I have to tell you, I really appreciate it. You all asked some very good questions, and I think it was a very good process. I also want to extend thanks to staff that were went to every single one, of course, and I really appreciate you guys doing that and the work that you provided to the committee as well. Today we are hearing two different capital budget requests. We will not be taking official action on those. I just thought it would be helpful for the committee to be able to hear about these projects. So with that, Representative Erdahl, I'm going to hand it over to you, and you're first up.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members. This is a capital budget proposal for restoring historic structures at Fort Snelling, which I think we can all agree is one of the most important historic places in Minnesota. These improved facilities will welcome visitors in historic structures adjacent to the historic fort and the Mississippi River. The project will enable the Minnesota Historical Society to reach new audiences by telling a wide variety of stories about Minnesota through the fort's history. We have with us today Minnesota Historical Society Director Steve Elliott, and he'll provide more details about what is planned to be done.
Welcome, Mr. Elliott. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yes, I am Stephen Elliott. I'm the Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for taking time today to hear this overview of the Minnesota Historical Society's capital budget request, particularly the historic Fort Snelling request. And thank you, Representative Erdahl, for bringing this legislation forward for the committee's consideration today. We sincerely appreciate the legislature's support for funding for pre-design for the historic Fort Snelling project in 2015, which is helping us to keep this project moving forward. We're excited to provide a progress report on pre-design for this important project. Madam Chair, a quick mention that the Minnesota Historical Society has three requests in 2016. We'll spend the bulk of our time on historic Fort Snelling, our highest priority request. Second is historic sites asset preservation, which will enable us to take care of the facilities entrusted to our care. And finally, the county and local historic preservation grants request to provide assistance to local units of government to help them to take care of their most significant historic structures. What I'd like to do this morning is to present a very brief history of the Fort Snelling area, then review the exciting plans that we have for this important historic site. Fort Snelling is a place that has a very long history and is very familiar to many Minnesotans. Yet the paradox is that while it is very well known, there are many stories relating this important place that are not known to many Minnesotans. Our goal with this project is to involve Minnesotans more deeply in learning about this place and its engaging history, and to provide the facilities that will make this learning possible. When we think about Fort Snelling, we usually think about the establishment of the fort in 1820 and the years immediately thereafter. But if we pull back from that pinpoint in history, we have to look at the fact that that area has been a crossroads for a very long time. As the confluence of two major rivers, it's been a meeting place literally for thousands of years of human history. The archaeological record for that area goes back at least 8,000 years, and humans have probably been meeting there for more than 10,000 years. In the late 17th century, contact was first made between whites and Native Americans, and that contact became more frequent as trade picked up. And in the early 18th century, Zebulon Pike stopped at this site on his way to his peak further west. And after the War of 1812, as the United States was eyeing the British to the north, the United States sent a party under a man named Leavenworth to scout a site for a fort in this area. Now, think about the United States at that time, and think about where this was compared to where the United States was. This was the northwesternmost outpost of that eastern seaboard country. Leavenworth was succeeded by a guy named Snelling. And Josiah Snelling and his troops began in the fall of 1820 to construct a fort on the bluff at the confluence of the two rivers. In the ensuing decades, this was the site where contact intensified, where an Indian agency was established, a site that was the center for trade. It was the site of many treaties, large gatherings of Native Americans and whites to negotiate treaties. And in those decades after the fort's establishment, in any given year, there were between 15 and 40 slaves at Fort Snelling, because the Southern military officers were stationed at outposts. They brought with them their slaves, and they were compensated for the service of their slaves. One can look today at the payroll records of the time and put names to those people. Two names ring out in American history: Dred Scott and his wife Harriet. And the basis for Dred Scott's case for freedom, which went all the way to the Supreme Court and was decided by an infamous decision in the 1850s, was their residency in free territory in Minnesota at Fort Snelling. During the Civil War, Minnesota, one of the newest states, was the first to respond to Lincoln's call for volunteers. 24,000 Minnesotans left for that distant Civil War through Fort Snelling, and the fortunate ones came home through Fort Snelling. The importance of that can't be forgotten. There were only about 150,000 to 170,000 Minnesotans in the early 1860s, and only about 50,000 able-bodied men between the ages of 16 and 49. While those men were away, Minnesota had its own home front war in 1862, the U.S. Dakota War, and of course Fort Snelling figured in that. Soldiers were dispatched from Fort Snelling to fight in the war, and in late 1862, nearly 2,000 non-combatants, Dakota children, women, elderly men, were marched and spent the winter in a stockade below the bluff at Fort Snelling, and were dispatched by riverboat the following spring to out-of-state reservations. In November 1865, two of the Dakota leaders were hanged at Fort Snelling. Following the Civil War, Fort Snelling continued to be active. The storied Buffalo Soldiers, the African-American regiment that fought in the Plains Indians Wars, trained at Fort Snelling. They were the first occupants of some of the barracks there. And as you turn the page into the 20th century, now this is less than 100 years after Fort Snelling was a distant speck in the wilderness, Fort Snelling becomes the portal through which hundreds of thousands of men from Minnesota and the Midwest pour to global conflict. First in World War I, and then in the Second World War, many Minnesotans have personal connections to this historic site. And in the Second World War, Fort Snelling was home to the Japanese Military Intelligence and Language School. About 6,000 Japanese-American soldiers, most of them second generation, many of whose families were in internment camps out west, trained at Fort Snelling to go to Asia to end the war earlier and help make the transition to peace. These rich and sometimes complicated stories connect Fort Snelling to major narratives in American history. We will tell these remarkable stories to school children, families, and tourists from across Minnesota and beyond. Our sense of urgency is to have this nationally significant site ready for its bicentennial in 2020 so that Minnesotans and others can continue to learn from our past. Minnesotans are fascinated to learn about the stories they haven't heard about the fort, and we look forward to positioning Fort Snelling as the major historical destination it deserves to be. I'd like to take a brief minute to review why the current visitor center is a bad further investment of public funds. This underground facility was built in the late 1970s, and water is a problem in the facility. In one recent deluge, water poured into an office area and literally destroyed the concrete floor of one part of the lower level of the building. Our sump pump in the elevator shaft runs 24/7. And in a medium-level rain event, our staff rigs up a system of tarps and hoses to keep water away from work areas. We've done our due diligence and determined that it's not wise to put additional resources into the current visitor center. Doing so would simply band-aid the constant water infiltration, which will not go away. So instead, in our master planning and pre-design process, we've determined that it's a wiser investment to take care of the nationally significant historic structures on the historic Fort Snelling campus, specifically buildings 18 and 22. So in essence, we will be ceasing to maintain the current visitor center and making adaptive reuse of historic structures that are currently mothballed. This National Historic Landmark deserves a facility that can better welcome visitors and orient them to the site and the stories they'll encounter. We've been busy doing pre-design work with the appropriation you provided in last year's special session. Our approach has been not only to work with our architect, Leo Daly, but also to seek input from a wide group of Minnesotans through stakeholder research and a series of ongoing public meetings, including veterans, American Indian, African Americans, and Japanese Americans, for whom Fort Snelling holds special significance. To date, we've held 8 public meetings with outreach to a broad group of community members. You also have a packet of letters of support from organizations such as the Friends of Fort Snelling and others, and I especially direct your attention to the letters from the teachers because I think they're spot on. We're excited to present this request that will make historic Fort Snelling a place that Minnesotans will be proud of and which will be a place for meaningful learning experiences for school children, families, and tourists from Minnesota, from our region and beyond. In the historic Fort Snelling pre-design process, we're planning to reuse one of the historic 1904 Cavalry Barracks buildings, Building 18, and Building 22, an 1880s Munitions Ordnance building that's adjacent to Building 18. During the pre-design phase, the goal is to match specific functions with potential space available. These conceptual site plans are a preliminary look at how the spaces in these buildings work to serve our visitors better with museum exhibits, classrooms, and other visitor amenities. In addition to work on buildings 18 and 22, it's essential that we improve the areas surrounding these historic buildings to provide an easy and understandable entry into the site, as well as provide better opportunities for visitors to experience the Mississippi River, which is an important part of this area's history and natural beauty. Our plan calls for demolition of the current visitor center and improved landscaping leading to the visitor center, along with improved river views from the visitor center to the historic fort. This work will require resources. Resources from the state of Minnesota will help us to preserve buildings that are part of Minnesota's first National Historic Landmark and provide an important educational experience for its visitors. We recognize that this is a large request. In doing our homework, we have learned that since Fort Snelling is so well known and appreciated by Minnesotans, there is capacity for bringing some non-state resources to the table. And we're pledging to raise $12 million privately to put towards this project to get it done. This is a significant amount of funding for us to raise, and it's a departure from Minnesota's longstanding practice of the state funding 100% of capital project needs in the statutorily defined State Historic Sites Network. But will you believe the private support is there, and securing the state's portion of the funding this session is essential to keeping the project on schedule for the Fort's bicentennial and enabling us to raise the private funds. Madam Chair, again, we appreciate your time this morning and appreciate your consideration of this important request. Time is of the essence as we prepare for 2020. I'd like to close with a 2-minute video that will give you a sense of the breadth of the stories we'll be telling at the new historic Fort Snelling and how this historic campus will be knit together by the improvements proposed in this project.
Before Minnesota became Minnesota, there was a place, a confluence of two great rivers where cultures and civilizations crossed for thousands of years, where something new was imagined, a remote American outpost built, a place of pride and sorrow.
It's a place of rebirth and birth, but it's also a place of great tragedy.
Historic Fort Snelling, Minnesota's first national historic landmark. In 2020, Fort Snelling will be 200 years old. In time for its bicentennial, we have a new, expanded vision for this site, where visitors connect with each other, with the many stories that bind us together, with the natural beauty of this extraordinary place. Our plan includes a new visitor center to replace inadequate and aging facilities, places for private reflection and public remembrance, a reimagined visitor experience sharing more complete stories of the diverse people who shaped our state and country.
Did you find it surprising that we did actually have slaves here at Fort Snelling?
Stories of the many soldiers who prepared here to fight for America. Soldiers who are buried nearby. With new investment, historic Fort Snelling will attract more of the millions who pass through this busy corridor every year by sharing an American story told nowhere else. With its bicentennial on the horizon, help us realize the potential of this unique place and position historic Fort Snelling for the next century and beyond.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Representative Gunn.
Just the question, which I think I should remember, but I don't, which was, when was the Visitor Center built or renovated?
Mr. Elliott.
Did you say that?
Oh. Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, the current Visitor Center was built in the 1970s, late 1970s, opened 1980.
Representative Kahn.
You know, I'm a little living in a neighborhood where the houses were built in the late 1800s. I'm a little disturbed at the short life of something that I'm sure I voted for. But what are we doing? And I'm not saying that this isn't the right decision, but what are we doing to present that kind of thing?
Right.
You know,
total taking down as opposed to just a renovation seems like an awfully strong decision.
Yep.
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn. That's a good question. We too are disappointed that a building that's 35 years old can't be efficiently rehabbed for future use. But we have learned over those years that there are deficiencies in the structure that we can't fix. We can only continue to spend money to remediate. And taking a look at that structure, the water infiltration, the consultants tell us, consultant after consultant, can't be stopped. We can expect to spend between $5 to $7 million over the next 20 years on the current structure just to band-aid or remediate the constant infiltration of the water into the building. When we've pulled up from that and looked at the fact that we have several original historic structures that we're charged to preserve, and we're replacing the roofs on them or repointing them, they're just sitting there mothballed. It seems to us that this is the time, this is the decision scene where the wise decision is to stop investing in that modern underground building and start investing in the adaptive reuse of those historic structures. The best way to preserve structures is to give them a use, and there's a use sitting right there that suits them well.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I'm not really objecting to the decision. I just wonder what's in our decision-making process so that we don't make something that it seems to me someone could have known before. Someone else who voted for it is here. Okay. Not just me. It's not just my fault.
I feel sorry for Mr. Elliott, Representative Kahn, because, you know,
yes.
when you go to that visitor center, whoever designed it probably didn't have a home in Minnesota. Because first they put it underground, and then they had everything going down into it. So, I mean, I think everybody knows yeah. you're going to have water in the basement, so to speak, if you do that kind of design work. And poor Mr. Elliott has inherited the
yes.
problem and has talked to engineers, and it sounds like you are trying to fix the
Madam
error
Chair,
from originally.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, you're exceedingly kind. Thank you. That was a time, I believe, when... there was a lot, you know, there was the energy crisis, there was was an underground
yeah.
building center at the University of Minnesota, and I believe the thinking at the time was going underground was a good idea. It was energy efficient, et cetera. Well, over time, we've learned not such a good idea, especially at a site like that, where there's water moving along the rock sheets,
yeah.
bound and determined to make its way down to the river.
Okay.
Representative Carlson.
Well, I think you just commented on what I was going to say. There was that period of time when going underground was kind of the popular thing to do. And another example of an underground building, and I hope it's working, was at the University of Minnesota in Representative Kahn's district, the Civil Engineering Building. And that goes down several floors. But they were all done during that period of time, and hopefully the one at the university is working, but this one, unfortunately, and we did, when I was on capital investments, some site visits there, and there is a huge water problem. So I guess I would just simply say, due to the energy crisis, that's why we were doing it, in part, as you pointed out, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, and this one unfortunately didn't.
Yeah.
Representative Kahn.
Well, since I grew up in a city that every part of it is an island, and most of it, huge amounts of it are underground, you know, I'm just kind of surprised that people didn't know more about what going underground means. I know it's a very different geology, but, you know, most of us, we're used to going underground almost every day of our lives, so.
Members, any other questions? Representative Detmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and... thank you, Mr. Elliott, for bringing this to our attention. And I'm sure there might be, in Representative Erdahl as an author, that book might be following this this project, probably. But, maybe not.
Good idea.
Yeah. But I see that $12 million is going to be augmented to, so we're really talking about a $46 million project?
Okay. Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, sir, that's correct.
And Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Elliott, has that money already been raised?
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have started to work on that, yes. We have, at this point, firm commitments for $4 million, and I've had conversations with some other prospective donors, and one of the responses I get is, hugely important place, means a lot to all of us. I'm really interested in helping you, but I'd like to see if the state does its share of this session. So I feel like my early feelers are supporting our sense that the money is there and can be raised. And I think with the state's piece in place this spring, I hope, then we'll be able to go back and raise the rest of the needed money.
Yeah.
Representative.
And Madam Chair, if I could just, we have a special guest here today from Forest Lake. We have a student, Remy Brisbois, but it's really pronounced Brisbois. And I asked him to just stand up, and he's here as representing the school. He's taken a CIS course, college in the school course, political science. And I asked him, have you visited Fort Snelling? And he said, yes, he has. So welcome.
Welcome, Remy. Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming today. The water problem, I agree with Representative Kahn. This is something that should have, and I'm guessing was probably discussed when the construction was originally done. And this demonstrates the importance of, when we take a look as a governmental body or an entity to solve some specific problem. In this case, it was an energy crisis. Now we're dealing with the reality of climate change. That we have to look at things globally, that those problems exist, but that we don't want to trade one problem for another, which is kind of what happened here. I'm assuming the water problem, because of the nature of them, occurred pretty much at the outset. You've been fighting this the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, sir, that's correct.
And then you had mentioned, I thought, an important point in that Fort Snelling is such an important element of the fabric of Minnesota. From a marketing standpoint, when we have all these different entities, such as the Mall of America, that bring people from all around the world literally in there, is there going to be a change in marketing? And this will be increase the capacity for visitors coming in here, but because of the proximity, that would be logical. Do you foresee efforts being altered as far as marketing visitation?
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, sir. We are looking at using these two approaches, telling a much bigger story, set of stories about Fort Snelling that connect to major narratives in American history, and the physical refreshment of the site by using one of the historic cavalry barracks in our marketing promotion to reposition Fort Snelling as a much more significant national historic destination. And I have to say, both the airport, Mall of America, everybody is interested in helping to support this because it will attract more people and will extend stay to have a site that's positioned at that level.
Representative Luna.
And I just want to end with a comment is that I come from an insurance background, Mr. Elliott, and I strongly agree with your comment that the best thing you can do for a building's longevity is to use it. And reappropriating that existing building, I think, is a great idea.
Members, any other questions? Representative Rembeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Elliott, just wanted to ask a few questions about attendance, comparisons with the current visitor center, and the size comparisons with the current visitor center. And then the parking lot, how many are you able to accommodate? How many cars?
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Representative, I recall you asked some very good questions last Thursday as well. Yes, the current visitor center includes both public spaces and then support space for the state archaeologist and our archaeology department and collections. The public space portion of the current visitor center is around 20,000 square feet. Building 18, one of the cavalry barracks has about 38,000 square feet. So we will have more space to better accommodate our different audiences there, especially school groups. One of the design shortcomings over time at the current visitor center is that we didn't design sufficient space to support the needs of school groups when they come. We are looking at reconfiguring the parking lot. I believe we'll have about the same number of spaces in the parking lot. I'm not sure the exact number. May I just look over here and see if my staff knows that?
Sure, if they want to come to the table and or whisper it in his ear.
About 300. I think we'll need about that number of spaces because the site is also becoming increasingly popular regionally as a place to come and explore the whole area and to connect with the paths down along the river. And I'm sorry, ma'am, I'm forgetting the other one.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Rembeck, could you compare or give us the current attendance averages?
Sure.
And what do you anticipate?
Yep. Madam Chair, Representative, the current attendance is about 75,000 people. About a third of the current attendance is school children coming on field trips. We think that'll increase significantly. And we're planning for that. And in our pre-design process, we also are conducting, haven't completed yet, economic analysis that will be more extensive market research and will enable us to answer questions, for example, about how and where we extend the seasons for the place.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I missed the opening comments here. Does this have any seemed to do with the improvement of the officers' quarters and the rest of the buildings there that are falling down, or was it only this one building?
Mr. Elliott.
Madam Chair, Representative. We are talking about the lower, here we're talking about the lower post of Fort Snelling, which in addition to the 1820 historic fort, includes 2-19-4 cavalry barracks, an 1880s munitions building, and one surviving of a series of horse and mule barns. On the upper post, which I think is what you're talking about, there are literally dozens of other buildings. A few of those have been rehabbed for veterans housing by common bond, and Dominium, the developer who has redone the Schmidt Brewery in St. Paul and Pillsbury A in Minneapolis into affordable housing, is negotiating with the DNR to rehabilitate about 26 of those other buildings on the upper post for housing.
Well, Representative Earhart.
Those are, I don't know, why aren't you asking for money for that, or is that all gone by the wayside now? I think the second year I was here, we were out looking at those buildings falling down, the roofs caving in, and all that stuff. And we never seemed to reach agreement on any kind of flow of money where they could be brought to usable status.
Mr. Elliott?
Madam Chair, Representative. We are not responsible for the upper post. We're trying to take good care of the piece we're responsible for. But there is movement on the upper post. I think that we all have reason to be encouraged at this time that some projects have been completed, and there is a developer with a good track record who is wanting to tackle 26 of those buildings. Mm-hmm. I think the DNR does have a small infrastructure improvement request for the upper post that will help make the development feasible.
Representative Earhart.
Is this DNR owner, are they in charge of the upper post then? Or? Yeah, strange. Mm-hmm. Are they hunting there?
There are deer out there.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Elliott.
May I answer that? Representative, yes, the upper post is a part of the state park. There is a joint powers authority that is a consultative body, but the DNR is responsible for it. And as I say, there is good forward movement on it.
Thank you.
Yes.
And then I just have one question on the kind of layout of how things are going to change. It has like an event area, so are people going to be able to host different events, or is this only events that are hosted by the Historical Society, or would members of the public be able to lease that space for a period of time, or how does that work, though?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. We are looking at, as a part of the repositioning of Fort Snelling, we are looking at ways to engage the community more continually out there. Providing venues for meetings and events is one part of that. We also hope that the community will increasingly see it as a place to come for forums and discussions, some of which we may host. Some may be forums, discussions, or events that are actually curated by others, and this is a venue for. That will not only connect the site much better with the life of Minnesota, but it will also strengthen its financial positioning for the long run.
Great. All right. Representative Erdahl, any final comments?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to present this morning. I want to assure Representative Kahn and Representative Carlson that no one is blaming them for this problem. And Representative Earhart, we're not real sure about. But anyway.
I missed. Try again.
We do appreciate the opportunity, and I realize that there is no vote taken on this today, but you are certainly encouraged to encourage Chair Torkelson and other members of the Capital Investment Committee to support this project.
Great.
Thank you.
And Representative Carlson and Kahn have questions, I guess.
Yeah, I wasn't... Madam Chair, but I will comment. I'm going to go in a little different direction than the water issue, but being that was alluded to just again, We had at the University of Minnesota what was known as the Underground Space Center. It no longer exists, but that may have also been one of the driving forces, because I think it was the only place in the country that had a center like that that was doing research and focusing on underground space. But that's not where I was headed. I just on a personal note, I grew up in South Minneapolis. My father did, and my grandfather, when he immigrated from Sweden, settled in South Minneapolis. Grew up most of the time a good bicycle ride away from the fort. But where I was headed was that during World War II, as a military family, my dad was overseas. We shopped at Fort Snelling, you know, the commissary, probably closer than most other grocery stores and so on, but you could get certain clothing items, you could get groceries, and I don't know whether we went there because the price was better, or I do remember a little bit of family history. There were certain items that you could sometimes get at the fort that were harder to get at a civilian store sometimes, so there was probably that advantage as well. And then I personally was out there as a kid. You know, kids have medical needs once in a while, and I remember going out to the hospital that we were eligible for that was at the fort. At least we called it a hospital. Maybe it was a clinic. I'm not sure exactly, but in terms of the family, it was referred to. But one thing, when you talk about the military aspect of it, that I still remember as a kid, because my dad was overseas and in the European theater, going out there one day, and there was this big chain-link fence and a lot of German prisoners kind of mulling around behind that fence. And we did have prisoner of war camps in Minnesota and in parts of Iowa, and I assume they were there until they were shipped out. I know my first teaching position was in St. Charles, Minnesota, down by Rochester, and there's Whitewater State Park down there. And it was one of the very few state parks that had cabins back when I was teaching, and I was teaching there in the early 60s. And the reason they had cabins was that those were the barracks for the German prisoners that were housed there in St. Charles. I don't know if that was a direct connection with Fort Snelling, but that was another aspect of it when you talk about the military history. I don't know if any of that part of it's documented. I was born in 1940, so I was old enough when I would go out there as a kid to remember some of that as well. So I just thought I would comment. And by the way, like Erdahl, I'm a former social studies teacher, usually government and economics, but once in a while American and world history, depending on the program needs of the school. But have an interest in the fort and in the historical society generally because of my teaching experience as well. And history is something that's I think very worthy of the investment in this case.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Kahn.
Well, my comment's nowhere near, just a comment, and it's nowhere near as interesting as Lynn's. But I was going to say that I'm probably the only person in this room who has canoed, run, hiked, and biked all around that area. So.
All right, Representative Runbeck, last question, because we do have another bill, and we are leaving today at 9:30. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as we have Representative Erdahl here in the room and the Legacy Committee Chair, what is if we look at the operating costs then and the programming, staffing, which sounds like it's going to be increased, do we have an opportunity to have Legacy funds pay for that? Or where does Legacy fit in, please?
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Runbeck. You know, with this, we run into the supplanting versus supplementing argument. We cannot take the place of traditional sources of funding for these things. But if there is, you know, newer programs, new funding, it's something that could be looked at through Legacy. But again, we can't take the place of traditional sources of funding.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, you said the key word, new, seems to me. I mean, have what it sounds like there will be opportunities for new programming, new things we haven't done before. So I would encourage us to think about that as a source.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck. And certainly, as I said, if there are things in that category that could be looked at in the future, certainly, even if we wanted to, we couldn't this year because legacy funds have either all been expended or we have to deal with. So it's already sent.
Members, thank you for your comments and questions on House File 2376. We are next going to move on to House File 1847. Thank you, Representative Erdahl and Mr. Elliott. Folks, before we do move on to that, we do have a couple of housekeeping items to take care of. Representative Nash is going to move the minutes for August 18th, February 10th, February 16th, February 18th, February 23rd, and February 25th. All of these minutes are in your packet. Hopefully you've had a chance to review them. So with that, all those in favor of approving the minutes for those days, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are adopted. We also have one other housekeeping item. This year we have a new page with us. Matthew, I know you're busy over there, but if you can wave your hand, tell us where you're from.
I'm from Madison, Wisconsin.
What?
What? Yes. I am finishing my last semester at the University of Minnesota studying.
Oh, okay. Redemption.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Well, welcome to the land of promise.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and I'd like to thank you all for having me.
Well, welcome. We hope you enjoy your stay with State Government Finance. Oh, yes. Okay, and Representative Clark, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Clark, I explained to your folks that we are not moving on any of these bills, but we did want to have a chance to hear them. So, Representative Clark, if you want to present your bill.
I will, Madam Chair, and we do have a PowerPoint, and when this bill is heard for a motion, it will have a reduction in the cost.
Sure.
And as an amendment, I believe that you probably all have that, so that we won't talk about that today, but it does reduce the cost to just a little over $1 million.
That's great. Thank you.
I'm really pleased to be able to present to you the Pioneer and Soldier Cemetery Restoration Project. This is one of the treasures of Minnesota. I'm sure that some of you have been there. It's an incredible place, site to visit, and it does have lots of visitors every year, but it really needs some help to get the restoration project, that the fence that protects it needs to be finished. And there's been participation from the city of Minneapolis and from the state before, and what we're asking for today is the amount that would be finishing that. I just want to say this, we're going to look at the PowerPoint and see what a historic site this is. And it's very interesting, I think, to know that this is a place where a lot of immigrants were buried, and a lot of soldiers from the War of 1812, Civil War, and Spanish-American War, and you're going to see some of that. And it's located in a neighborhood that is still very befitting what the cemetery is. This is a neighborhood in South Minneapolis, Phillips neighborhood, that has a very diverse population, so lots of immigrants in recent decades, and a broad diversity of people. So we're really proud of this cemetery, but we do need to protect it and restore it. And I'm going to turn this over to Susan Weir, who is one of those treasures herself, one of the volunteers in the community who helped keep this cemetery restored and protected to date. And we're going to show you the PowerPoint. She'll tell you more about it as we go along.
And that's great, and welcome, Ms. Weir. I'm going to have you state your name for the record, but also just as a reminder, we are leaving at 9:30, so if at 9:15, we can start questions if members have any questions at that point. So, Ms. Weir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as you can see from just our first slide, we talk about this as pioneers and soldiers. If you look at the picture, this is really what we're asking for funding for. You can see the pillars to the fence. The fence dates to 1928. But the cemetery itself goes back to 1853, so it was actually in existence before Minnesota was a state. And it's the oldest surviving cemetery in the city of Minneapolis, and there it says 20,000, but in fact 22,000 people buried there. If you were to drive by, or many of you, I think, have visited, you'll notice it doesn't look like that because only 1 out of 10 graves are marked. And that has to do with poverty. It has to do with the weathering of marble in Minnesota. Lovely, but bad choice for markers. And vandalism. And the important thing about the fence, one of the important things, is it protects this cemetery against vandalism, which is a critical issue for us. I think the fourth point is the one that's very interesting. For many years, it was the only cemetery in Minnesota that was listed as an individual landmark in the National Register of Historic Sites. Back in 2002, when the cemetery was placed in the National Register, it was extremely difficult to get a cemetery listed because, by definition, they're all historic. Makes sense, right? So it has to be something special. And that's exactly what we'll talk about that in a second. But by and large, the cemetery was privately owned from 1853 up until 1928. And at 1928, it was no longer profitable. And so the city of Minneapolis took over responsibility for maintaining this site. And it was also at that time that the cemetery was more or less closed to future burials, although there have been some in special cases since then. Talking about the community then and now, one of the reasons why this cemetery is placed on the National Register is because of its connection to the anti-slavery movement in Minnesota. Many of the earliest folks who came here from the East Coast certainly came for commercial opportunities, but many of them also came for religious conviction. In the 1830s, the Baptist Church split over the issue of slavery, and that was the founding of the Southern Baptist Church, and many of the others moved to Minnesota and founded the First Baptist Church of Minneapolis. And among those early members were Martin and Elizabeth Lehman, the founders of this cemetery. So the First Baptist Church really was synonymous with the anti-slavery movement in Minnesota, and for that reason, this cemetery was never racially segregated, and it was the burial place of choice for the early African American community in Minnesota. The Lehman family were really quite remarkable people, and there are many of them. Martin and Elizabeth had 13 children, all of whom survived to adulthood, each of whom produced at least one heir. So 5, 6, 7 generations later, there are roughly 1,000 Lehmans running around, and I have met probably half of them. They're wonderful people. The Native American community is very interesting because in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s, for the most part, they would have had different practices for dealing with mourning and grief. But we have a really significant person in the cemetery, a woman named Mary Prescott, whose Dakota name was Spirit of the Moon. And she was the daughter of Man Who Flies, one of the elders of the, at that time, the Lake Calhoun Band of Dakota people. And interestingly enough, their encampment was in what is now Lakewood Cemetery. But Mary Prescott married Philander Prescott, one of the early settlers out at Fort Snelling. He was a casualty of the Dakota conflict, something that Little Crow was quite upset about. Mary was taken captive, and she escaped and came back to Shakopee, where there still are many descendants of the Prescott family. Their son, Lorenzo, or Lawrence Tolliver Prescott, is a Civil War veteran. He is a Native American Civil War vet. And as I was thinking about this for this group, it all of a sudden occurred to me, I have no idea how many Native Americans fought in the Civil War, nor what happened to them, nor where they're buried. But we're very honored that we have one of them. And we also have grandchildren of Philander and Mary Prescott. One of our volunteers made this gorgeous, I wish you could see this thing life-size, poster of our veterans. We have 4 War of 1812 veterans, which is a bumper crop for this far west. These folks had to have been born in the 1780s, maybe the 1790s, and we have been in touch with all of their families. The state chapter, Minnesota state chapter, the Daughters of 1812, every single member of that organization has contributed to the restoration of this fence by adopting a picket in the name of their relatives. So, I mean, they have been big supporters of us. When we talk about the daughters of the Civil War, they gave us, just recently, $1,000 because we are replacing the military markers for some of our veterans. The markers date from 1888, and I have just filled out 14 rather lengthy applications to get those replaced, and there will be a dedication ceremony for those folks, we hope, sometime this year. Of the 22,000 or so people buried there, we know that over 10,000 of them are children under the age of 10, which is horrifying in its way. But it's also very telling, because what we can tell by looking at those children and the causes of their death, the improvements in health care that have occurred in the last 100 years, and most significantly, the fact that we now filter our water. These children died in by the thousands because of contaminated water. So that is a really significant thing, and it's the kind of thing that you can see when you look at these records and you look at tombstones and you look at the dates and see the stories of these people. We have a Grand Army of the Republic plot over by the Lake Street Gate, and it is 24 graves, and those graves were purchased by the Grand Army of the Republic because they did not want Civil War veterans buried in the proper section. So these are men who were by and large penniless, in many cases familyless, and the Grand Army stepped up and said, we will take care of you. And this is where on Memorial Day, the current veterans, American Legion Post number one, placed wreaths and they fired the 21-gun salute. There has been a Memorial Day observance at this cemetery for 148 years, from the year that General Logan issued his orders, we're there. And it's quite the event. It's a very small, it has a small town feel to it, with the band and the vets and Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Junior ROTC. It's quite an amazing thing. These are photos of some of the people who are buried there. Captain John Cheatham, he was, to the best of my knowledge, the first African-American firefighter in the city of Minneapolis, appointed in 1888 by obviously a white chief at that time, who was promoted four times. He retired as a captain. And this is before civil service, so this tells you a great deal about the character of the man. The man next to him with the lovely beard, that is Martin Lehman, the father of those 13 children and the owner of this cemetery, and one of the most honorable people. He's an unsung hero in the state of Minnesota, but a very honorable, well-respected man. Captain Charles Nutt is one of our Civil War vets, and we tend to use this picture a lot because he's very dashing. He's an attention getter, so every time we have a poster, such as our poster for Memorial Day, there he is. We use him a lot. And the little girl is interesting, Skjold Rasmussen, Danish, the daughter of Danish immigrants, died in 1893. And her family was so poor that they had no marker, but some of her descendants have tracked this down. And in the early 2000, the minister from St. Peter's Danish Church came out and did a graveside funeral for her and her sister. And interestingly enough, we had another funeral, sort of, I don't know, called retroactive or belated, this past year, also for Danish immigrants, which I thought was kind of a, we have a trend going here. This gives you sort of a feel. We have literally right now hundreds of pictures of people who are buried there. And the way we use them is when we have events at the cemetery, we have a couple things. We have a smartphone history hunt. And for people like me who don't have a very smartphone, we put out these photographs on people's graves so people can see who it is that they're looking at, you know, whose story it is that they should be paying attention to. And here is the request for funding. The fence was built in 1928, and since the restoration started in 2006, much of it has been, the steel pickets have been, for the most part, restored. We have a little bit turning the corner on 21st Avenue that needs to be done. But the next piece here is to do the pillars. The pillars are limestone. And what they found when they went to rehang the Lake Street gates is that water had been seeping down from the top and eating out the inside of the pillars, and so it required some metal structure to support the weight of those gates. And that's true throughout the cemetery. So the plan is to take them apart, reassemble them using the correct adhesive this time because there have been, unfortunately, a few bad jobs of patching. And then to put a cap over the top, which will not be visible from the street, but which will prevent that water from seeping down into the pillars. So, and you'll see on the diagram that little yellow patch there. This one always makes me laugh. That is historic chain link. It dates, and frankly, it's as ugly as modern chain link. It's 1928. But it is easily reachable. It is something that people can cut through and get into the cemetery and vandalize. And so the plan is to put, it will not be an identical replacement because you can't do that according to National Park Service standards, but a compatible fence that will both protect that side of the cemetery, but also to provide a little aesthetic service to the people. That used to be the High Lake Shopping Center, and now there is residential properties there as well. So they have been looking out over this chain link fence for a number of years. So that's the plan. $1.029 million to complete what has been essentially almost a $2.5 million project. And it's to restore the 65 pillars and to come up with some new fencing that is compatible with the old fencing along 21st Avenue. So here is the financial breakdown. I am not the wizard who came up with this. Someone else may speak to that if you have questions, but shall we finish up the history and come back to that?
Great.
Generation of volunteers, what we've been trying to do here. Friends of the Cemetery is an organization. I am chair of that organization and have been since, I guess, we started. It's an all-volunteer organization. Every single person there is a volunteer. We have someone who has scanned 100,000 documents, taken over 20,000 photographs in that cemetery. We have a website that is really quite interesting. And we do a number of things throughout the year. I already mentioned the Memorial Day. I wanted to tell. In 2009, we had the first ever rock concert in that cemetery, Jeremy Messersmith, and he packed them in. We had 1,500 people, which is almost unimaginable. And in addition to the money that we raised from ticket sales for that, American Express thought we were so creative and weird that they gave us a $20,000 gift. To apply toward that fence. They just thought it was an unusual use of space, which it truly is, but it's one we have repeated. We show movies. We show an average of 4 movies a year. In Memorial Day, we do Buster Keaton silent films with a local band that plays live soundtrack. And then in the fall, we tend to have sort of goofy, family-friendly things like Alien Invasion. And these are all fundraisers for the cemetery. They serve another purpose, though, and that purpose is to get younger people involved and engaged. The smartphone history hunt that I imagined, we set that up before the movies, and people are wandering around looking and learning about the people who are buried in the cemetery. And that's the goal that we have been working with. We have 1,500 and some 60-some followers on Facebook, which, given that we started with about 30, is pretty interesting. We give tours for the Minneapolis Community Ed or Preserve Minneapolis, free tours on Memorial Day. We've had 4 Eagle Scout projects. The kids have been working on military markers and did a magnificent job of cleaning them all before last year's Memorial Day service. We had 100 Brownies and Girl Scouts from the Mississippi Valley come in and do a cleanup. South High students come in and use it as a classroom. We've had U of M interns. We've made maple syrup. We've done just about everything you can to call attention to the cemetery. And just to let you know, that's my way of saying this is still a very active place. We are very much in the business of teaching people local history as much as we can, and this is our draw. This is our way of getting them in. So these are the defense for us is to protect all of this, you know, to keep these stories intact, to keep this place intact, so that people can enjoy, but people can also learn, and also so people can take care of the place. It mentioned to date we've raised over $50,000, so I told you part of that was a concert. The rest of it was adopt a picket. We have had people adopting pickets in the fence for $30, and we have 700 or 800 of those that have been adopted, and the rest have been through ticket sales for concerts, movies, those kinds of activities. And we have just very recently gone into the publishing business. So we have now founded Friends of the Cemetery, the Weep, Read Them and Weep Press. And for those of you who are poker fans, the logo is the dead man's hand. It's aces and eights. It's what Wild Bill was holding in Deadwood.
Thank you, Ms. Weir. I appreciate your presentation. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. And I have visited the cemetery, and but I'm looking on page 8 of your financial breakdown. The total cost of the project is 2.584. You already raised 1.574188, and you're asking 1.029. That equals to 2.603188. So that's a difference. There's $16,188 there. Where does that come in?
Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Melissa Lesh with the Intergovernmental Relations Department of the City of Minneapolis. And Representative Emmer, you're accurate. These were the closest kind of rounding numbers that we could get from our finance staff in the last couple of days. Okay. So we can get that really, really precise. But we were aware that there was a little bit of wiggle room in there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess when I look at this, my question kind of stems to what happens on the north side of this. It looks like we've done everything. Everything's in the east, south, and west corner there, but what happens, what prevents anything from the east, or is that, or from the north, or is that already done?
Ms. Ware.
Two things. The north side is, one of the boundaries is the Midtown Greenway, and this is up a huge slope. So it drops off from the fence. I'm not very good at estimating, but it would be quite a woof to get up to the top. You would really have to want to do that very dramatically. And by and large, the acts of vandalism, if you look at cemetery vandalism worldwide, not just here, is almost always idle activity. It's, you know, well, I would say it's kind of beer and brawn. People who have too much time on their hands and something. So it really requires a sustained effort. The straight piece on the north side, there's kind of a jog like that. That is actually the transfer station for the city of Minneapolis. So there is a rolling gate that blocks off that piece of the fence. People cannot enter that once business hours are closed. So that's fairly secure compared to the 21st Avenue side.
Representative Howe.
Well, thank you. And I kind of enjoy your comment about the beer and brawn, but that's exactly the time that they're going to try and do something stupid like that. But Is it still active? Is it still an active cemetery? There's no interments going on there as of today?
We have had, the most recent was 2002. You can still be buried there. People always ask us, are you going to be buried there? Well, no. Unfortunately, I don't qualify. The answer is you can be buried there if you already own a deed, which they haven't sold since 1919, and you have a relative buried there already, and Minneapolis City Council approves it, which they will if you meet the other two. So the most recent one, actually, I misspoke when I was talking to Representative Clark. I said it was a descendant of one of our War of 1812. But it was not. It was Bernice Miggs in the Chicago Airfield. That is how she is connected. She was 2002. Hers were cremated remains. Remains, one of my least favorite words. The last full casket burial was not documented, but was believed to be in the 1970s. And yes, we do have people. I was teased, one of the members of our board has two empty spaces there, and he and his wife are eligible to be buried there if they choose.
Representative Howe.
Is there a cost then?
Yeah.
Ms. Ware.
You know, it's happened so rarely that I don't really know, but yes, I'm sure there would be, because the city certainly is not in the business of opening graves, so I would assume it would have to be associated with some kind of funeral, some mortuary business.
Representative Howe.
But they don't have to buy a lot. If they they qualify to be buried there, there's no purchase of a cemetery plot.
Right, and they probably paid all of $10 for it, so that was planning ahead.
How many plots are left?
Well, actually, several people were removed in the 1920s, so there are 5,000 of them, although we did plant trees. In 2003, we planted 150 trees for Arbor Day for the 150th anniversary, and I figured out where we could safely plant without disturbing anyone. So a few of those are taken up.
Representative Carlson.
This is turning out to be the history of the Carlson family, I guess. Warning. But as Representative Clark knows, and I did a site visit there, I have a great grandmother and an aunt who I, my father always talked about a sister that he had that died in childhood. I'm not sure exactly how old, but I kind of perked up when you said a number of them were under 10. But as I mentioned earlier, my grandfather had immigrated from Sweden, and after he got here and got established, his plan was to bring his parents over, and in the meantime, his father passed away. And so he was able to bring his mother over. And I'm still not totally sure what her name was here, because in Sweden she was, I think, Swanson, and her husband was Carl Swanson, and then that's where the Carl's son comes from, if you're familiar with Swedish culture. But I just learned here that I have other plans, but in terms of where I may end up. But apparently I might be eligible to be buried there, and because I have relatives there, and I might even have some others. I'm not positive. Those are two that I recall. But I did. I thought it was closed. I thought when we did our site visit there that it had been closed in terms of burials sometime in the 1920s. I talked with you when we did the tour, Madam Chair, but no, I guess you don't need to qualify that, because I've just learned that apparently if there are some circumstances where it is open for burial.
It was reopened for burials in 1936 when the wife of a Civil War veteran passed away, and they had purchased plots, and it had always been their intention to be buried next to each other. And so that's when the City Council passed an ordinance allowing these exceptions.
And just a quick comment, Madam Chair, the future generations, if you follow the history of cemeteries in Minneapolis, or especially South Minneapolis, in case of our family, shifted to Lakewood in later years, and that's where we have family plots, where I may end up one day. But but at any rate, I'll stop there. I just have that long history in South Minneapolis. I moved north to the north side when I started teaching at Henry High School, and on the north side, so I ended up buying a home on the north end, and so I shifted. Most of my family still lives south. My father used to say, "Oh, Linden moved way north," kind of like I was at the Canadian border or something, because they were so south side oriented. But I'll stop there.
Members, we have Representative Kahn and Representative Earhart, and then we're going to adjourn. So, Representative Kahn.
One very quick comment. One of the things that this points out is, of course, the cost of war. And when I was in fifth grade, a very long time ago, let's say sometime in the late 40s, our teacher, only fact I remember from elementary school, I think, our teacher came in and said that they had just paid off the last cost of the war of 1812. Mm-hmm. And it was someone who had enlisted in the war of 1812 as a drummer boy, lived to a very long life, and very late in life married a very young woman who also lived to very late in life. So it took until then to pay off the War of 1812. So,
Representative Earhart.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. When we visited there a couple of years ago, I have relatives there, Civil War related and so forth. And but the filing system was 3x5 cards. Has that been updated to any extent? Or? I couldn't find them. They recognized the name, but it was...
Ms. Ware? Yeah. It's an interesting question. The original cards are actually in Minneapolis City Hall up in the turrets, in case you're ever wondering what's up there. And they're covered with a great deal of dust. The cards in the cemetery office, the 3x5s, are actually a Works Progress Administration project. Those were retyped in the 1930s. There are a fair number of typos, to be honest. So if you're looking for somebody, the best way to do that is to contact Friends at the Cemetery, because I have a spreadsheet of 22,000 names and 30-some columns across and can sort them lots of different ways. And so I was just thinking, just one kind of last comment and almost a joke, is that of our 22,000 people, 1,035 of them are named Johnson. So I don't believe it.
Well, I had a cousin.
Representative Earhart.
I did have a cousin in town last summer, and she did locate somehow some of the relatives. So,
is this Chris Nesland?
Excuse me?
Is it Chris Nesland?
No.
Oh, okay.
It was Roth.
Roth?
R-O-T-H was the Frederick. Name of the cousin. But I don't think that was the relative's name. Anyway.
I just have one quick question. So the limestone, they're putting an entire sealer over all of it, correct?
No, just the cap. To keep really? The water from seeping down.
Oh, and that's still going to be sufficient?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Representative Clark, final comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to your recommendation on this bill. It's, as you heard, it really is a unique treasure, and I'm looking for your support. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, and thank you for coming today. Appreciate it. Members, we are going to adjourn. GOP members, we're meeting in room 454. And with that, we are adjourned.